The clerk will call the next case.
Bowman versus Virginia State Bar, Gregory Wade, Appellant's Counsel, Samuel Towle, Deputy Attorney General, Madeline Gibson, Assistant Attorney General, Marshall Ross, Trial Section Chief, Appellee's Counsel.
Mr. Wade, can you hear me?
Yes, sir, I can.
Is there some reason? There you go. Now we can see you. You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Gregory Wade, and I am representing Craig Bowman. A brief bit about Mr. Bowman. Mr. Bowman has a very local practice. He's a Virginia Tech graduate and a Richmond law graduate, and for the past 40 years, he's been practicing law about 3 miles from where he grew up and went to high school in Mount Vernon, in a strip shopping mall with over a bank building. He's got walk-up steps in the back. That's where he's been. What we think we have here is, in essence, a fee dispute that has metastasized into an ethics problem. But when we look below the ethics violations, they're really not there. A couple of things to keep in mind that there was a fixed fee paid. That fixed fee at all times stayed in Mr. Bowman's escrow account. Never left it until the committee ordered him to make a partial refund to Ms. Wright, and that's what he did. Never a question of taking the money for himself, always there. Number two, there were some sanctions in addition to the, I don't think it was a reprimand, I think it was a public rebuke or something less than a reprimand. In addition to that, there were some sanctions in terms of making a repayment to Ms. Wright and taking some CLE. It's all been done, that's all completed. So he's fully complied. The board in this case, acting in its appellate capacity, made no findings of fact, no conclusions of law, and simply affirmed the committee's decision. So in a way it makes it easier because we have no board issue to deal with. The issue is the committee's decision. The pivotal document in this case is the committee's findings of fact. The committee's findings of fact are in the joint appendix. They're numbered paragraphs, joint appendix, page 15 and 16. They contain the findings of fact. The way that I understand this process is that there is a body of evidence, all of which you have, all of which the committee had access to, some of which they read, I hope, all of which they heard. Then from the evidence, they make findings of fact. Those findings of fact, if they legally support a violation of the Code of Professional Responsibility, support that finding, and then there are sanctions. The pivotal and the primary issue in this case is whether those findings of fact on your appendix, on our appendix 15 and 16, support the conclusion. Now, there's also another pseudo issue that is kind of embroidered throughout this case, and that involves an inventory and accounting. First of all, trusts never provide inventories. That's a term that's used for estates when a commissioner of account wants an inventory. But she was asking for an inventory, so we're going to deal with that issue. And the second involves an accounting. In this particular case, as you will see, this was a joint revocable trust between husband and wife. It left everything to each other. It's what I call an I love you trust. Except there were certain items of personal property that were specifically designated to go to the stepchildren. So the question of an accounting is, what do you account for? Well, how do you account for an item of personal property? Well, the way you account for an item of personal property is identify it and give it to them. And that's what Mr. Bauman did. They were supposed to get a shotgun and a bishop's chair. He sent him a copy of the trust. Trust said, bishop's chair, shotgun. He later gave it to him. That's the accounting. I mean, that's the inventory. That's the accounting. Now, one of the issues is the scope of his work. He did not complete the scope of his work. His work included dealing with the issue of the accounting and the inventory. And he was terminated by Ms. Wright without cause, primarily because it wasn't convenient for her to get to him. She was perfectly happy with him. She was terminated. After she was terminated, the issue of the accounting came up again. It came up in the beginning, and Bauman's approach was, once we give them the items that they're attached to, there's no need for an accounting. And this went on for months and months and months. In fact, it's clear in the record, everybody forgot about it. Even the opposing counsel in her deposition says she forgot about it too. There was a miscommunication. And the reason everybody forgot about it is because it's a pseudo issue. And it was just one of these things that sometimes you do in litigation, but truth is, there's nothing to it. They had no right to any of the assets. What they really wanted, they were curious, wanting to know how much money the stepmother got from their father. And that was something that they had no right to. Now, Mr. Bauman sent him a copy of the trust, but the copy of the trust contained no information about the extent of the assets. It's just a document that says, you get this, it says they got a shotgun and a chair. He had to, and they say it's a violation for him to send it to him, but he had to send it to him because the statute says he had to send it to him. Plus, they knew about it already. If you look at the very first letter that the first letter that my opposing counsel sent to Ms. Wright, I think it was July 7th, 2015, she referred to a trust. She knew it was a revocable trust. She knew the date of the trust. She knew the name of the trust. So the existence of the trust was never a secret. What was a secret was the financial items that were in the trust. That information was never given to the stepchildren, ever. Trust itself is merely a skeleton. What's in the trust is an entirely different matter. He forgot about it. Everybody forgot about it. Wright terminated him. She didn't terminate him for cause. She just, well, it's over. This is finished. She sent her daughter. They picked up all the records and it was done. Finished. Well, weeks later, another letter comes back. How about the accounting? Remember, at that point, Bauman's not representing her. She's been terminated or discharged. She picked up all the stuff. She didn't want to have anything more to do with them. He sent her a copy of the letter. What else is he supposed to do? He doesn't represent her. Is he supposed to get on the phone with Miss Scott and start arguing about it? He sent it to her. She never comes back, never says, you got to finish the job. She goes out and hires another lawyer, primarily because it was inconvenient for her to get to him. That's what she said. Too many stairs. Well, what happens is the committee looks at it and says, you never finished the job. It's true. Findings of fact. Never finished the job. That's true. Why? Because he was terminated. Okay? For no good reason. So that's a clear violation. It's clearly improper to conclude as a matter of law that a lawyer who doesn't complete a job because the client prevents the lawyer from completing it has violated ethical standards. But that's what they found. The other thing involved fees. This was a fixed fee contract. Bauman wanted hourly rates. She said, no, I want to know what I'm going to have to pay. He said, fixed fee, $7,500 plus expenses. She agreed. Okay. The money went straight into escrow, and the money stayed there. Now, what happened was, because she terminated him and the job was never completed, it was subject to a quantum merit analysis. That is, how much is he entitled to? Well, he's entitled to some quantum merit amount, but the committee looks at it and says quantum merit means an ethical violation. Clearly, that's not the case. Quantum merit has nothing to do with that. There's no way you can. They didn't find, for example, that $7,500 was too much. They didn't even deal with the idea of how much it, of how much the fee should have been at the time it was set. That's the issue. Somebody comes in 2 years ago and says $7,500. Am I out of time? And says $7,500. You have to go back to that time and look at it, look at what's anticipated, what's going to happen, and how much. They didn't even touch that. The committee didn't even look at that, didn't even mention it. They assumed that because it was subject to a quantum merit reduction, that it was a per se violation. Clearly improper. Do I have 4 minutes and 39 seconds left?
You have 2 minutes and 55.
Okay. In that case, if I may, I will reserve the rest of my time. Thank you very much.
All right. Ms. Gibson?
Yes. I'm sorry, my screen has frozen for a moment. May it please the court, my name is Madeline Gibson, and I'm here on behalf of the appellee, the Virginia State Bar. The board's findings of professional misconduct in this case were correct. I intend to address the challenges to the sufficiency of the evidence first, and then we'll turn to the challenges related to the board's standard of review and the due process challenge as well. But at the outset, I would like to make some corrections to the facts as presented by my friend on the other side. First and foremost, contrary to what he has stated here, the board did make findings of fact. And those findings of fact are crucial here because as this court has long recognized, the court applies a deferential standard of review to the board's factual findings. The court views them as prima facie correct and will sustain them unless they're not justified by a reasonable view of the evidence or are contrary to law. In addition, the court views the evidence and all reasonable inferences in the light most favorable to the bar, which means that to the extent that Mr. Bauman is contesting the factual findings of the board, conflicts in the evidence are resolved in the bar's favor, not Mr. Bauman's. So the board's findings of fact are contained in the district committee's determination order, and those were incorporated in full into the board's memorandum order. And what the board found was that Mrs. Wright paid Mr. Bauman a flat fee of $7,500 to resolve a trust dispute. And in exchange for that fee, Mr. Bauman agreed to accomplish two objectives. One was to coordinate the transfer of items of personal property, and the second, which was most important to Mrs. Wright, was to determine whether Mrs. Wright had to comply with the stepchildren's demands for a copy of the trust agreement and an inventory and accounting of trust assets. Ultimately, her objective was to resolve those demands, and that is what the board found. The board further found that during the period of the representation, which lasted 14 months, Mr. Bauman never advised his client about her legal obligations under the trust, never told her what was happening in her case, and withheld material correspondence from her. Adding insult to injury here, Mr. Bauman made critical strategic decisions in the case by deciding to accede to the stepchildren's demand for a copy of the trust and by deciding to ignore the accounting and inventory issues without ever consulting with Mrs. Wright. By the end of the representation, the board's finding was that the only objective that Mr. Bauman accomplished was the transfer of personal property. The board affirmed the district committee determination in full, finding that Mr. Bauman's conduct violated rules 1.2A, 1.4A, B, and C, and rule 1.5A of the rules of professional conduct. So starting first with the violations under rule 1.2A, there are two questions before this court. They are whether Mr. Bauman abided by his client's objective to resolve the trust dispute, and whether he appropriately consulted with her about how to achieve that objective. And the evidence in the record certainly supports the board's finding that Mr. Bauman committed misconduct in both respects. And Mrs. Wright's testimony is key here. She testified that her objective was to resolve the entire trust dispute, that it was her chief concern in the case and primary objective, to resolve particularly the demands for an inventory and accounting. And it's undisputed here that for over a year, Mr. Bauman did not resolve, nor did he attempt to resolve the inventory and accounting issues. My friend on the other side has admitted here today that Mr. Bauman did not complete this objective. It's not disputed. And this was a straightforward violation of the Rule 1.2A duty to abide by a client's objectives. In addition, Mrs. Wright also testified that Mr. Bauman never consulted her about his strategic decisions in the case. His decision to fax a copy of the trust agreement to Ms. Cross and Mr. Bauman's decision to ignore the inventory accounting and accounting issues were clearly the means of representation that Mr. Bauman chose to pursue in this case. So under Rule 1.2A, he had a clear duty to bring his client in on those decisions, to seek her input and to consult with her before making those decisions. Comment 1 to Rule 1.2 states that both the lawyer and the client have a responsibility and authority regarding the means of the representation. So this was another additional two violations of Rule 1.2A, and specifically the duty to consult with the client. Mrs. Wright's testimony was not only that Mr. Bauman failed to consult with her, but also that he failed to communicate on any level with her throughout the entire representation about her case.
May I interrupt you for a minute with a question? I'm sorry. May I ask you to address the $7,500? If I understand the record correctly, it's a fixed fee. It's not a escrow fee that you bill your hours to. And it's not like he did absolutely nothing. He didn't do hardly anything on her objectives, as you suggest, but it's not like he did nothing. So isn't the right answer legally that when you have an escrow and you haven't taken it out of escrow, which would be a terrible problem if that were the case, you leave your in this case, fixed fee retainer in escrow, you've done something, there's a dispute with the client as to how much you've done, isn't quantum merit the way that dispute normally gets resolved or should get resolved? And what should a lawyer do when a lawyer says, you know what, I'm sorry, I didn't do it. I didn't get the job done. But I can't give you the whole 75 back because it's not like I've done nothing. So let's work this out. Is that wrong for him to have done, or did he actually do that?
Justice Kelsey, if we look at Mr. Bauman's letter to Mr. Desio, he doesn't say, let's work this out. He doesn't say, this is a dispute over an amount. He flatly refuses to refund any portion of his $7,500 fee and then recites justifications for why he gets to keep that fee. And more practically, he did not issue a refund. And comment 4 to Rule 1.5 states that once the representation ends, part of the ethical duty under Rule 1.5 is to refund any portion of an advance fee that's not earned.
Counsel, this is Justin McCullough. Am I correct? The position on appeal remains that nothing is due to be refunded, right? My understanding was both at trial and on appeal, he's saying I earned the fee. So it's not a question of him. It's not a question of him saying, "Hey, she thinks I should repay 7,000. I think I've earned at least, 2,000. Whatever. It's just binary, he's just saying I earned the whole fee.
I agree with you, Justice McCullough. That appears to be the argument. There's been no proffer of how, what refund would have been appropriate. Mr. Bauman simply contesting that $2,500, was not justified by the factual findings when, of course, it was. The board incorporated the district committee's careful consideration of the factors in Rule 1.5A, particularly considering the results obtained, the skill required, the time and labor required here. And it's clear that, to Justice Kelsey's point about the work that was done, there was work done. And that work amounted to approximately 20 emails exchanged between Mr. Bauman and Ms. Cross and Mrs. Wright regarding scheduling dates and times. In addition, Mrs. Wright did say that there were about 2 to 3 phone calls about scheduling, but that was the long and short of it. The fact that Mr. Bauman refused to issue any refund, and as you say, Justice McCullough, his position is he didn't owe one, there was clearly a violation. And second, the factual findings support that $2,500 was certainly justified under the circumstances. And I think key here is Ms. Cross's testimony about her own fee. Naturally, the scope of her representation mirrored the scope of Mr. Bauman's representation. She actually did more work than Mr. Bauman. At the very least, she engaged with Mr. Desio after Mr. Bauman was out of the case, and her total fee to her clients was $1,100.
And also the new attorney, Mr. Desio, who came in, explained this was a fairly simple matter to resolve, and he, with minimal research and effort, he was able to accomplish the client's objectives. So it wasn't an Armageddon of a legal case that dragged on and required all this effort.
That's correct, Justice McCullough. There were factual findings made by the board that not only was it unethical for Mr. Bauman to keep his whole fee at the end of the representation, but that it wasn't a reasonable fee to begin with. And that's what Mr. Desio's testimony speaks to, that this was not a complex issue, that this was a matter of reviewing about 2 statutes, relevant case law, and about 5 pages of the trust agreement. So this was not a significant legal undertaking. But moreover, the work that Mr. Bauman actually accomplished in this case wasn't even work that required legal acumen. It was scheduling. So those are the principal reasons that justify that misconduct finding under Rule 1.5. Moving on, turning to the assignment of error regarding the board's standard of review, Mr. Bauman's argument is that the memorandum order of the board failed to include an adequate legal analysis, specifically of how the factual findings supported the rule violations. And that argument fails on its face because the rules of this court don't require the board to include a legal analysis of that extent in its memorandum order. If we look at Part 6, Section 4, Paragraph 13.1 of the rules of this court, that contains the requirements for a memorandum order. And regarding substantive findings, that provision requires only a brief statement of the findings of fact and the nature of the misconduct shown. In Kuczynski versus Virginia State Bar, which is a 2014 opinion, this court held that those provisions don't even require a complete listing of the facts that support a rule violation, let alone an analysis of how those facts are applied to the rules, which is what Mr. Bauman appears to be urging here. So based on the plain text of paragraph 13, it's clear that the board's memorandum order met the limited requirements of that rule. Pages 486 to 490 of the joint appendix is where that memorandum order is. It incorporates in full the district committee's factual findings, as well as the misconduct findings, and also contains its own description of the nature of the misconduct shown. So that assignment of error should be rejected by this court. And turning finally to the constitutional issue, and I apologize, the timer on my computer has stopped, so I don't have a precise view of my time.
1 minute 23 seconds left. I'll let
Thank you,
go.
Thank you, Justice Lemons. So turning finally briefly to the constitutional issue, the board correctly rejected the argument that the sanction scheme deprived Mr. Bauman of due process. And there are numerous reasons that compel this court to affirm the board, and they are contained in the bar's brief. I'll just highlight a couple key points here. And they are most fundamentally that this court has already held that the bar's disciplinary procedures, including the sanction scheme, are constitutional in Pappas versus Virginia State Bar in 2006, and again in Kuczynski in 2014. This court held that the procedures outlined in Part 6 protect the rights of the attorney. And furthermore, it's well-settled law in this court that a disciplinary proceeding is civil and informal in nature, and therefore the due process requirements are not the same as in a criminal case. The only case that Mr. Bauman cites in his brief is a criminal case, in fact, a death penalty case. Here, due process is satisfied as long as an attorney receives notice of the charge against him and an opportunity to answer. And of course, Mr. Bauman doesn't dispute that he received both of those protections here. And in fact, he received more because the bar goes to great lengths to provide trial-like conditions at disciplinary hearings. So Mr. Bauman had a very full opportunity to present and argue his case.
Your time has expired. Thank you for your argument.
Thank you.
Mr. Wade, you have a bottle?
Yes, thank you. Just a couple of things. We're not saying that the board did anything improper. We're simply saying that there is the absence of any factual analysis by the board. They simply accepted what the committee's analysis was. That's why I refer to the committee.
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey again. If I may refocus you back on the fee issue, the $7,500 issue. The argument, as you're hearing from the bar, is that $7,500 was an excessive fee to do a next-to-nothing job, and he didn't even do that. I mean, that's the basic argument on the fee. And he didn't ask for quantum merit, and he held the money in escrow sort of by hostage. What's the best comeback to that, if there is one?
Well, there was no finding ever that the $7,500 fee was excessive at the time it was imposed. That's why they have a flat fee. They don't know what they're getting into, so they charge a fee. There was no findings of fact. If you look at the findings of fact in the committee's determination, it says because it was quantum merit, that means it was excessive. And for the $7,500 to be excessive, you have to go back to the time that it was set. They make no discussion about that. There's no findings about that. Don't exactly know what you're getting into. But the point is,
I think the board is saying is if you want the whole $7,500 and you don't want quantum merit, or if you think what you did justifies $7,500 and that's what you insist upon, that's just unreasonable. Isn't that what they were saying?
That's what they were saying, but we are not insisting upon that. Nowhere ever in anything that we wrote will you say that we insist on the $7,500. In fact, he immediately refunded it. What it is a fee dispute. If you also recall what Mr. Desio did, Mr. Desio made one demand. He says he wants him to return it minus what he was entitled, plus he wants $4,000 for himself. That was the demand for the phone call. And I guess it would a whole lot better had Bauman gone back, but it's not a violation to say in a fee dispute, I want a fee dispute arbitration panel, and I'm not paying you $4,000 for the phone call. That's the position of Bauman. He never maintained, and we've never maintained, that he was entitled to the full amount because we acknowledge the job was not completed.
Justice, can I answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
All right, your time has expired. The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, and the justices now will reconvene in the justice conference room.